This storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
That is the pure face prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You cause confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit great today.
And DeSantis, to a certain degree, has imbibed some of the, like, he's demonstrated some of the principles that people like myself and Aaron have talked about. So, you know, these are positive. It doesn't, like, everybody thinks, I think, that elite theory is blackpilling, right, Aaron? But actually, it shows the path of what you need to do, right? Although the blackpilling part is when you then realize, oh my gosh, we're up against, like, the entire Death Star, right, the entire Empire. You know, just the amount of resources our enemies have is just overwhelming sometimes. So
the Rebel Alliance was a good example of an organized minority, though, and they did blow up the Death Star. So it's not that fulfilling.
Well, it is for me because I'm pro Palpatine, but we'll get to that.
One more quick question for both of you. Do you think it's the case that the modern man is actually the human who understands elite theory the least? Like, have people historically had a better intuition about these things that has been deliberately subverted? You know, have we been educated out of understanding some of this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really critical part, again, of the transition to the total state, to the total bureaucratized, centralized state. You couldn't have achieved this if you didn't explain to people that they have achieved some level of individual autonomy through their input into the government. The idea of self-government has robbed people of the ability to understand how power works. And that was a really key part of severing the connection between consequences of rule and the actual power of rule.
Yeah, I think James Burnham, who was one of the elite theorists, he has moments where he really comes at a problem in a different way. And I think it's in Suicide of the West. So don't quote me on that. But there's this one moment where he's talking about the consequences of teaching everybody to. Your kind of liberal assumption is like, well, it's probably good that people can read and write, and, you know, mass education is a great thing. And he's just like, this made it easier to propagandize people. So it's just like the actual consequence of mass education. Like, he saw it back then in like 1940 or whatever, or 1960, that it just makes it easier to get a lot of people to think in the, you know, easier to sell newspapers to, easier to propagandize. And I think the television only magnified that. In fact, the internet in many ways, I mean, this is a point many people have made. I mean, it has blown apart their messaging a little bit. That's why all of us are here. And it's taken, let's just say, the Empire a couple of years to figure out how to deal with this. And now they're regrouping and regaining control over the messaging and so on. So we need to, you know, we need to, what do they call it? Make hay while the sun shines. We need to still exploit this little opportunity that we've got before they shut it down completely, which they will do eventually. If we let
the internet was like the little unprotected thermal exhaust port on the east side that gave a little window of hope.
I mean, the most optimistic take is that it's the Gutenberg press versus the Catholic Church, right? And that they're never going to put the genie back in the bottle. Optimism I had around that has kind of been put to bed by COVID and Ukraine a little bit, to be honest, because their ability, the media's ability to reprogram people in real time is just remarkable.
But luckily, we, you know, have plenty of practice bullseyeing womp rats back home, so it shouldn't be a problem.
Amazing. All right. Thanks so much for joining me, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. See you guys.
Excellent. All right. AA, I'm now regretting not picking Star Wars as the topic to talk with you about.
I know.
But
I've been doing shorts on Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's got to be some chunky Star Wars streams on your channel at some point. But I picked postmodernism because it's actually something I very much want to hear your thoughts about. It's a topic I find interesting, but I also think lots of the people who talk about it, either the rest of their worldview is completely messed up, or they don't know what they're talking about. Whereas you are both sensible, you know, centered and informed.
I think the first thing we have to do when we talk about postmodernism is differentiate. I think there's a habit on the quote-unquote right to basically just call postmodernism like all left-wing thought since 1960 or something like that, right? Like the postmodern left or something like that.
Peterson's approach.
Yeah, you know, the cultural Marxist and all this sort of stuff. It's not quite as straightforward as that. The first thing we have to do is, like, well, what is modernism before we talk about postmodernism, right? And the modernists were guys generally writing in the first half of the 20th century in literature. It was people like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. You can pick whatever field you want. There were modernists in art. There were modernists in, you know, various different fields. Literature is the one I know best, right? Wyndham Lewis was a modernist. We've done a number of streams on modernism in art on the Deepest Lore on my channel, and what modernism was a kind of attempt to understand and to come to terms with the kind of alienating experiences of living in modernity, right? If that makes any sense, where modernity is kind of scary and it's new, and people feel small in the new mass consumerist age, right? If you read a poem like T.S. Eliot's, you know, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, or you know, The Wasteland, it's trying to find a language to express what it means to be in this modern world, right? But it doesn't necessarily reject that modern world, and in some cases, depending on what flavor of modernist you get, there's a kind of embrace, you know, like the futurists, for example, embraced the technology and they were like onwards and upwards type thing. But regardless of what type of modernist you got, for example, T.S. Eliot was a Christian, you know, and he still believed there was a God and still believed in capital T truth. Regardless of which flavor you had of modernist, they still believed in big truth, right? Whether it's God, whether it's science, whether it's progress, capital P progress. It doesn't, I mean, you understand what I'm saying, right? It kind of wasn't yet so cynical and so disillusioned that it did away with these kind of grand meta-narratives, I guess you'd call them, about the world, right?
So they're like Whiggish ideas.
You could have a modernism which has a Whiggish form. You could have a modernism that has a Christian flavor. You could have a modernism that has even a fascist flavor, right? But the point is that regardless of which style of modernism it is, it still believes there's such a thing as truth, a big truth out there, and we're trying to find it, right? We're all in this together, guys, and we're trying to find this truth. You know, maybe the fascists wouldn't say that we're all in it together, guys, part, you know, but we Italians are going to find the truth or whatever. And we embrace the future. So there's a kind of, even though in modernism, you get alienation and you get a struggle and you get a sense of a loss of tradition and all of these sorts of things, you also still get that, I don't want to call it naive or wide-eyed. It's just a kind of sincere, a kind of sincere belief that there's an absolute truth, something like that. Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, postmodernism really comes about after World War II. It's a post-war phenomena, right? How can I put this? Imagine you're living after World War II, whether you're German or you're Jewish or you're British or French or whatever. You're just a European after World War II, or an American. Well, the Germans, they read Shakespeare. They listened to classical music. Some of them believed in God. In fact, everybody in Europe did. And they still pretty much destroyed the place. I mean, we don't even need to get into the other atrocities that were carried out. You know, or the communists, for example, right? The communists, they believed in socialism and the future. I mean, they killed millions and millions of people. So after you have this kind of mass catastrophic event, which was World War II, which in many ways, Europe still has not gotten over. I still think it dominates our imagination in ways that is not always fully appreciated. You're never that far away from World War II coming up in any conversation. I mean, there's even a name for it, right? What's the law?
Yeah, the thought terminating thing on the internet. Yeah, I'll find it. But yes.
Yeah, there's some sort of...
Everyone's thinking about, like, the popular discussions about what's going on in Ukraine is basically couched in World War II language. Is this World War II again?
Yeah.
Are we about to see World War II happen?
Exactly. Or, you know, you're never that far away from, you know, the mustache man coming up, et cetera. So in such an environment where you have this catastrophic event that happened that destroyed Europe, you know, in the case of Germany and France, whole cities just bombed, lost, right? Even in this country, you know, there were places hit by the blitzkriegs and so on that had to be rebuilt. How can Europeans, after such atrocities have been carried out, after such devastation, after such destruction, possibly go back to believing in the old truths? Whether the old truths is the capital G God, religion, Christianity, whether it's a belief in science and progress, whether it's a belief in whatever the flavor of modernism happened to be, how can you go back to that? Because look at where it led, right? So there was some thinkers who started to abandon the idea that we should have these what they called grand meta-narratives, a big story that explains all the other stories, right? Like the Bible, for example, is a grand meta-narrative. It's a big story that explains all the other stories. I don't know, the kind of progressive view of capital S science. It's a grand story that explains all the other stories. And so you got certain people who then wanted to start to deconstruct and pull apart these grand meta-narratives. One of the most famous of them is called Jean-François Lyotard. He was a French guy. A lot of them happened to be French. And he saw it as a kind of positive mission, in a way, to what artists should be doing now and what thinkers should be doing now is basically smashing apart and pulling down and destroying all of the grand meta-narratives that have got us to this point, okay? Whether it is the grand meta-narrative of religion, whether it is the grand meta-narrative of science, whether it is the grand meta-narrative of Whiggish history, for example. Every single one of these was now grounds to be deconstructed, pulled apart, shown up, etc. And to be replaced with nothing, which is the, I guess, the kind of existentialist part of it, right? We are beyond grand meta-narratives now, because grand meta-narratives lead to things like World War II, right? Something like that. So this is one version of postmodernism. This is the kind of active variant where it's a kind of active style choice that you now, your duty really as a person now is to pull apart all those things that I was talking about. So that's one version of it. Any questions at this point, or should we?
Yeah, I was wondering how it relates to skepticism, the idea that you just don't believe anything that you're told. You assert you need positive proof, and you refuse to just assent to things.
I mean, that sort of skepticism really, I would date back to the Hellenistic period and to people like, what's his name, Zeno, and various other Greek.
The guy who got his students to lead him around. And
yeah, I mean, I would go back to the Greeks for that sort of skepticism. Likes of Lyotard.
Is there an influence there? Or
No, likes of, you've got to understand, the likes of Lyotard and various other postmodernists, they didn't really care about, like, capital T truth anymore. They just didn't care. They just wanted to pull down these other grand meta that they weren't. So for example, like the new atheist, like Richard Dawkins, right, is not a postmodernist, because he was trying to pull down one grand meta narrative, the Bible, religion, Christianity, whatever, right, the God delusion, as he called it, and he was trying to replace it with another grand meta narrative, science. Whereas these thinkers in the 60s and 70s, mostly from France, were actually trying to show that all grand meta-narratives are, at the end of the day, arbitrary. Even science. And this is one of the more radical parts of it that could be of interest to some of us today, right? Is that somebody like, I mean, Michel Foucault is somebody I would include in this. He was, I mean, he tends to be called a post-structuralist, but he's recognizably postmodern as a thinker, I think. I mean, he has a lot of critiques of psychiatry and the way that science is used by power, or Lyotard. He ends up in a position where he's kind of, it's not that he's anti-science, he just kind of shows up what we would recognize today as scientism, right? He shows up that as being just another type of religion in a way, which is just as arbitrary as all of the other grand meta-narratives that he's breaking apart. You know, another grand meta-narrative might be, a Whiggish history would be another one, right? Or it's any big story that explains all the other stories. Even communism, right? Socialism is something that a true postmodernist couldn't be a socialist, because Marx is yet another grand meta-narrative that tries to explain everything, and they don't want that. So it's kind of a I don't want to say it's nihilistic, but it's a kind of a destructive thing, that style of postmodernism. But there's another style which I'll tell you about in a minute.
Just one follow-up quickly on that then. Is there any of this thinking in the kook sphere or amongst conspiracy theorists?
No, there isn't, because the kook sphere, they have their own grand meta-narrative, right? Which is that the world is run by a hidden hand, Illuminati, lizards, whatever else, which basically explains everything else. You know, in the kook sphere narrative, there isn't really a war going on between Ukraine and Russia, because Putin is secretly working for the hidden hand. They're all in it together. All historical events, including World War II, are actually the results of the hidden hand.
Are there still people around today who strongly believe, are they in the academy? Where are the modern postmodernists, and do they matter?
I would say the tools of this style of postmodernism, the questioning of grand meta narratives and so on, have been disseminated into the academy as part of the kind of general toolkit that is taught to most students who do humanities degrees. They'll all do some sort of module where they cover this sort of stuff, and they learn how to use these skills, right? But what has also happened, ironically, is that a new grand meta-narrative has kind of risen up and slipped into the void, right?
Right.
And one of the things I've been very interested in doing is, in a way, using a lot of their toolkit against them, right? I mean, my Boomer Truth Regime stuff is very postmodern in its deconstruction of the grand meta-narratives of the post-World War II order, right? The kind of liberal myths that we tell ourselves. But at some point, the left stopped doing that and started believing in their own kind of, which is all of the anti-white CRT woke stuff, right? Which a true postmodernist would rip apart very easily too and show to be yet another bullshit.
It wouldn't have been a surprise to, say, Foucault, that once you dismantle the existing meta-narratives, whoever's in power is going to reconstruct a new one for their interests.
No, I suppose it wouldn't have been, but I guess he died before he saw like the fruits of his own labor. But I mean, he does a lot of very interesting things. Like, he's got a book on the history of sexuality, where he shows, the kind of constructedness of things, right? But he, unlike, and this is why he is postmodern as opposed to some of, like, a Marxist. Like, I did a couple of essays recently on Louis Althusser, which I put on my Substack. Now he is not a postmodernist because he's still a Marxist, right? That means that when he is talking about ideology, he always has in mind that the ideology is going to be replaced with a communist one. Right, so he critiques capitalism, and he shows how it works, and he shows how power functions, but his end goal is always the Marxist order that comes to replace it. Okay. Whereas Foucault, I don't think it had any replacement in mind, right? And I mean, I don't want to speak for him, right? Because obviously he died of AIDS in 1983 or something. But I feel like if he had been around today, he'd be engaged in the sort of stuff that we're doing, critiquing the left, because it's a recognizable power structure that needs to be pulled apart. Also, he supported things. I'll give you an example of something he supported. He supported the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, which is basically an Islamic theocracy which was traditionalist in nature. And I guess he did that for his own kind of anti-imperialist reasons or whatever, but they don't often lead to conclusions that you might imagine, right? I think he was just kind of interested to know maybe how... I guess he would look at Iran under the Shah, and he'd think, well, these are like Western forms being imposed on an old civilization that won't be able to brook them, right? So it's better for Iran to have its own forms, even if it's coming out of radical Islam or whatever, right? So I don't want to just say, well, you know, someone like Foucault, just an evil leftist, although he did support quite a lot of bad causes, I would say, like lowering the age of child consent, and, you know, obviously he was gay, so he had kind of his own agenda as well, you know, stuff like that. But
if Noam Chomsky had died in the 90s, you would probably assume he would have also been on our side by now.
No,
right?
Well, no. You see, Noam Chomsky was also a Marxist, you see, or he was committed to socialism. And this is really where, in fact, it's interesting you mentioned Noam Chomsky, because there was a famous debate that took place between Chomsky and Foucault, where you can see in that debate the difference between somebody like Chomsky and a true postmodernist like Foucault, who, you know, Chomsky had this idea of kind of like scientific ideas about linguistics and so on, whereas Foucault was he was kind of like breaking it apart and using his kind of post-structuralist lens to kind of cut through, whereas Chomsky's arguments would be called essentialist in some way. He was arguing there's a human nature that preconditions the sorts of languages we can learn, that there's a kind of language instinct in us, right? Mm. For Foucault, everything's about power, you know, everything's about social conditioning and texts upon texts and things like that. So,
so you wanted to give the other half of the... So we've seen the people, the postmodernists, who do you want to just quickly give a summary of who we've seen so far, and then who are the other half?
Yeah. So broadly speaking, the definition I've given so far would be, I've generally been following the Jean-François Lyotard type line. Okay. Although we've talked about Foucault a bit as well. Okay. I want to put Foucault to one side a little bit though, because he is very much a thinker in his own right, who's kind of unique, and he doesn't neatly fit into these sorts of boxes. So if I was to say, like, look at one thinker to define postmodernism, it would be Lyotard in this first sense, okay?
Okay.
There's also this second sense, which is a Marxist definition of postmodernism. The essay that always springs to mind to me is by Frederick Jameson, although, sorry, Luke, I'm getting old and I can't remember the name of it, okay?
Sure.
For somebody like Jameson, okay, postmodernism, or the postmodern, is actually the name given to this moment in what he calls late capitalism, okay? Hmm. It is... it is a kind of, I'm trying to find the words here.
Postmodernism, or the cultural logic of late capitalism, is probably...
Exactly, that's right. That's right, Luke. That is the book indeed. As he talks about how capitalism, as it progresses, starts getting less and less about... kind of like industrial manufacturing and stuff like that, are much more about the kind of endless mass reproduction of various forms and of its own ideas, if that makes any sense, right? It's probably easier to talk in terms of actual examples, okay, of what Jameson is talking about. Have you ever watched X Factor?
Yes.
Right. I remember watching an X Factor once where the contestant was doing a rendition of a song by a previous winner of X Factor, right? It was like Gareth Gates or something, and they were doing their version of Gareth Gates.
Yeah.
And on the panel, there was another former winner sitting on the panel, right? And I don't know if you know anything about Cheryl Cole, but Cheryl Cole at one point was on Pop Idol. So she is also, yes. Right.
She was part of that group, wasn't she? Yeah.
Yeah. She was part of some group that was originally on one of those shows. Well, the thing is that even in the first place, Pop Idol and X Factor and whatever, right.
Mm-hmm.
But for Frederick Jameson, even ABBA or Michael Jackson or the Beatles in themselves were pastiches of previous forms sold back to the masses. Right. So there's this kind of loss of authenticity in capitalism, whereby you just get the endless pastiche version that gets further and further removed from the thing itself.
Why is this unique to capitalism? Wouldn't this also have happened in folk traditions?
Well, I mean, you see that there is this, how can I say, like a kind of Marxist, kind of snobbery, I guess, about mass culture. So, I mean, even the Frankfurt School has an element of this. So, like, the true authentic object is something like, you know, William Blake making his own books and giving them to his friends, something, right? Okay. It's a unique art object that can't be reproduced. To answer your question about the folk tradition, they could say, well, that's a living, real folk tradition. That's authentic in and of itself, right? But the Beatles, or let's say the Sex Pistols, where, I mean, the Sex Pistols are a very good example, right? Because Johnny Rotten and friends had to audition for their parts in the band. A capitalist is now thinking, how can we create a commodity out of this art form? How can we take those ideas that came out of original folk forms or these authentic, real, living traditions, and how can we turn them into product? And it is this commodification that produces the inauthenticity, the pastiche. And in one of his more famous essays, again, I can't remember the name, I'm afraid. Maybe it's in that book that you mentioned somewhere. He says, think about going to Las Vegas. The experience of being in Las Vegas, right? I don't know if you've ever been, Luke, or you've seen it on TV or whatever, right? But in Las Vegas, you could be like, oh, there's Paris. There's the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's the Statue of Liberty. Oh, look, we're in Venice now. But of course, it's all fake. It's all fake, right? It's all a pastiche of those things. It's a plastic version, a plastic replica reproduction of the original object, okay?
Hmm.
So there, there you can say, there you can very easily see what he means by pastiche, right? That Las Vegas is not real. It's a fake version of all of those things. But what Jameson then says is that actually what capitalism does is that even the real Paris and the real London and the real Venice, okay, are
pastiches.
Are commodified pastiches of themselves. And I don't know if you've ever been to the real Paris, but the Eiffel Tower could almost be like the pastiche of the Eiffel Tower. Hmm. You've already seen the Eiffel Tower a million times on television, on postcards. It's meme to death, right? You've lived the meme version of the thing. So the authenticity of whatever the real Eiffel Tower was is now commodified out of itself. Does that make sense?
Reminds me of you're walking in nature and saying, oh, it feels like I'm in Skyrim.
Exactly. That was a very postmodern comment, right? And this is, I guess, the kicker of Jameson, right? So for Jameson and for Marxist types of postmoderns, right, it's not an active choice. You're stuck in it. I don't know if you've ever read Paradise Lost or Faustus by Christopher Marlowe. In Paradise Lost, Satan says at one point, listen, it doesn't matter if I go here or I go there. I'm in hell wherever I go, because it's a state of mind. You can't escape being in hell by physically removing yourself or going into nature or going to a nice part of the world or something. Where I am, where I stand is hell, right? Mm. And what Jameson ultimately is saying is that being in the condition of postmodernity, as we all are in quote unquote late capitalism, is basically like that. You can't escape it. it doesn't really matter if you go to the Tibetan mountain and you meet the authentic monk. You are a postmodern subject, and therefore you will process it in a postmodern way. And, you know, long-time watchers of mine will recognize some aspect of this idea in my idea that we're children of the ashes, who basically, because we're children of the winter or children of the ashes, basically like can't escape the taint of those ashes. This is really a rearticulation of Marxist postmodernism without the bit about the late capitalism, which I think we can do away with, because you can get there a different way through Spengler and Vico and various other thinkers, right? But presumably this is the
term late capitalism betrays the Marxist roots because it's a prediction. It implies that the current era will end.
Exactly. And I feel like you don't need to take all the Marxist crap with it. You can just, like, for example, Michel Foucault, who we mentioned, talked about truth regimes or epistemes, right? In Spengler and in Vico, you can't ever get, like, I mean, I've talked about this before. With the best will in the world, right, you, Luke, cannot embody the 10th century monk. Right? You just can't do it.
Yes.
It's absurd to think that anybody can, right? Because you just can't recreate every aspect of those conditions, right? And likewise, you take the 10th century monk and you magically transport him here. He also could not, like, it doesn't matter if he'd lived here for 20 years, he'd never quite acclimatize because it's so alien to him, right? So this, I think, is a profound idea that we need to kind of come to peace with. And that is why I think I came up with this label, postmodern traditionalist. When I use it, that's what I mean, really.
You're in the Jameson camp.
Well, I think I'm closer to being in that Jameson camp, although I do think the tools of deconstruction and so on can be useful to us, because I also see it as our mission to destroy the boomer truth regime, as I've talked about. So I'm a bit of both. I'm a bit of both. I wield, you know, with my right hook, I've got one. But it doesn't really matter how you box, you're still stuck in it. This is why I think that it will take to do what is truly necessary, right, eventually, will take a different generation who have been born and brought up in very different conditions from the ones that we're used to. I've said it so many times. I grew up watching He-Man and Thundercats and WWF wrestling and eating Chinese takeaways. And okay, all right, I may have had a few trials and tribulations, but I have not experienced the sort of suffering necessary to create the sort of man that is required to do what is necessary and has been historically. Mm. Right. And I think that the image I would point people towards, millions upon millions of people out in the streets of Rio and of Brasilia and all around Brazil, crying out for a leader. And while those people were out on the street, Bolsonaro was sitting in Florida eating a KFC. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, he is a product of his time. We're all product of our time. To one degree or another, that is inescapable, and it will, you know, to not have that mindset, to not be in that kind of thinking first of, you know, your own stomach rather than your duty to history and your nation. Could have been a hero, but no, he's eating KFC, right? It's just the mindset. Whereas Napoleon, faced with, you know, extraordinary circumstances, had a very different reaction. But maybe he only had that reaction because he lived at a time where he suffered, you know. So
I I feel there's something about both halves of this postmodernism that is inescapable. So on the Jameson side, I remember a video essay that was very formative in my thinking, Everything is a Remix. I don't know if you ever watched that, but goes through pop culture and shows. I mean, I saw one more recently where it went through Star Wars and showed all the films that it was ripping off, as it were, which is when you understand that, then it shows you that the quality of art usually is about importing the good ideas that you've experienced rather than creating out of whole cloth. But even on a broader cultural scale, I mean, like half the buildings in London are attempting to look like Roman buildings that are themselves attempting to look like ancient Greek buildings. Mm-hmm. And even Egypt, as I understand it, the majority of Egyptian, ancient Egypt, as we think of it, is really trying to replicate a much older kingdom that they were longing to return to. Mm-hmm. So that revelation about human nature and our reliance on reinterpretation, I agree with, but I don't have the same negative feeling towards it. I just embrace that.
There is a, you see, they do talk about this as well, though, which is like, what is the difference between, there's a writer called Roland Barthes, who I'm sure some people are familiar with, who talks about the difference between readerly writing and writerly writing. Okay. Whereas readerly writing is just the kind of lazy reproduction of something you've already done in a particular genre, right? Whereas writerly writing is creating something new. And his example is Balzac. I don't know if anybody's read him. Okay. The problem is that in this endless pastiche mode, there comes a point where you're just sapped of genuine creativity and newness, right? The obvious example to point to in the current time, you know, you mentioned Star Wars, right? Well, Star Wars, which in itself was a pastiche of 1930s pulp, as we all know, and various other serials and things that George Lucas liked when he was a kid. Yeah. Well, that created this idea of the massive movie franchise, right? And now it's just endless Marvel movies, endless franchises, and it's just so repetitive and tiresome and bereft of anything new. And I think that's the sort of thing that Jameson has in mind. So even if he says, well, the Beatles in themselves were pastiche of skiffle or whatever, we can recognize the spark of something new in Beatles, right? Mm. But by this point, they've been repeated so many times. Mm. They have been covered and pastiched and so on and so forth so many times that by now in 2023, you know, you turn on the radio and it's like, oh, God, another one of these horrible songs with, you know, the auto-tune vocals and the shitty R&B hook and all of that. So this is really what both Jameson talks about this and even Oswald Spengler talks about it, where it's like a kind of death, you're circling the drain. It's like, how many diminishing returns are we going to have before somebody actually starts to do something new again, right? So yes.
It seems like there's a principle where things slowly drift back through entropy to match the background noise state. You know, if there's a standard level of human output that is of low quality, over time things will return to that level. But every now and again, there is this moment of order, you know, an escape. Like maybe it's not a complete novel moment, but something like the Beatles or something like the original Star Wars is putting pieces together to create something that's greater than the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is almost also the same mechanism that produces new civilizations, perhaps, that the entire decline of a civilization is just this entropic
effect. Yeah, there's a guy on YouTube called John David Abert, right? And he has done a very long series of streams on Spengler, which I'd recommend to people. It's probably the most thorough look at the decline of the West on the internet anywhere, right? And probably will be, like, I don't think anybody will ever top the thoroughness of the Abert series. But he has a book, which is a collection of essays on films and things like that, called Cultural Decay Rate, where he believes that you get the long Spenglerian cycles over the course of the whole civilization, but you also get these mini Spenglerian cycles where you get something like, I don't know, the birth of cinema, for example, which has these kind of little high points, but then it too experiences its summer, autumn, and winter, and then it's like a straight line down until something else comes along. And he has some very interesting essays in that book on the history of film and the history of pop music and things like that, where he has all sorts of like theories as to why you get these upticks where you get these bursts of creativity, and then how they get kind of copied and then tired out and clapped out before they need to be replaced. So kind of interesting, very interesting thing to think about. Yeah.
I wonder, is Barthes more of the deconstructionist, would he be on the Lyotard side of postmodernism?
He tends to be thought of as a structuralist / post-structuralist, depending on which era of Barthes you read. So, I mean, it's kind of difficult because there are no easy labels for these people, because like the word right. postmodern is like a kind of catch-all phrase. Yeah, I feel like he was probably more interested in some of these questions about how do you really create something new versus just something that's tired and generic, you know? Because I think that people do have that bias, basically, where you can kind of tell the difference between like a kind of a genre novel, right? That is just kind of all tropes that you've seen a million times before versus something that is challenging, right? I should mention that when it comes to this question, I don't actually know if I agree fully. I'm something of a big film fan and big music fan, as you know, Luke. I actually have the view that for all of history, most stuff produced is shit. But in every year, pretty much, you will find some like gems in the rough. Like in amongst all the rubbish, there'll be somebody doing something interesting somewhere. So I don't really have this idea that there's like necessarily, you can kind of point to periods where there are more good artists and periods where there are less good artists, right? I feel like in my actual reveal preferences and so on, I don't really believe that it's a constant spiral downwards when it comes to art. But that's just my own like personal view. I don't know how that meshes with postmodernism, but I just feel like it's kind of distribution of talent thing rather than something epoch defining or something like that, you know.
The concept that there is this downward spiral from the second group seems like it's in conflict with the disbelief in meta-narratives, because that is a meta-narrative, isn't it? The inevitable spiraling of culture over time.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget, this is why I distinguish between the Marxists and the Marxist postmodern and the first type.
But did the two groups consider themselves to be at loggerheads at the time?
Yeah, I think so. I think Lyotard and Jameson are very commonly contrasted and juxtaposed. I don't know if they actually like wrote to each other or whatever, but I feel like Jameson in particular would want to pick apart Lyotard as a kind of just a product of his time, right? That's what Marxists like to do. Whereas I think Lyotard, if he was approaching Jameson, would make exactly the move that you're doing, saying, "Hold on, Jameson, you're imposing a grand meta narrative, aren't you?" You know, it's kind of like a different. Imagine two mages fighting each other. One's coming with fire spells, and the other one's coming with water spells or something. You know,
that's interesting because this term postmodern is just thrown around as though it was a group of people who agreed with each other, but it's literally just all of the things that happened as a reaction to the Second World War, at least as you're framing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I feel like Jameson would say that it almost doesn't matter that the Second World War happened, because whatever would happen in a capitalist society, you'd end up here, is what he would say. That this is just a consequence of living in a mass consumerist society that it kind of strips meaning out of everything and gives you the kind of world of endless pastiches. I actually don't have the negative view that a lot of people have. Like, I don't share Jameson's snobbishness, for example, about pop culture. I feel like I was born at exactly the time in 1982 where I can appreciate it all. I love Seinfeld. I love I love my pop records. I get all the references. I love my Tarantino movies. Why do I love them? Because they were made for me. We are the children of the winter, right? And this is like winter art, if you want to put it that way. It can speak to me because it speaks to my concerns. It speaks to me now in a way that, I don't know, listening to the music of the summer may not grab me in the same way. Why? Why can it not grab me in the same way? Because I cannot embody the spirit of that time. It can only come to me as an alien voice, if that makes any sense. Now, this is where some people will disagree, right? Like, somebody will want to say, no, the eternal truth and beauty of Bach or something, or of Shakespeare, or whoever, you pick a great artist, right? That is going to transcend the time and the place and so on. And I think there's some truth to that, right? There are eternal truths, right? There are things that transcend time and place. And that is why we remember people like this, okay?
Hmm.
But also there's this other part of me that thinks, yes, but you're never going to experience those things in the same way as the original audiences, right? In Shakespeare's plays, there are tons of contemporary references that will just be lost on us. They're just lost. We're just never going to get them, right? People he's making fun of, little political jokes that he makes. Like, we can't recover those original contexts, and they were there, right? And it's the same with anything. The original context is never, you can never reproduce it. So in a strange way, it's always the past speaking to us, right? And I always think, like, well, if you approach somebody like that, like Shakespeare, in a humble way, you can let the past speak to you, and maybe you can learn something from it, right?
Hmm.
You can never fully embody it because of what I said earlier on, Children of Winter, and so on.
Hmm.
And in much the same way, I reckon if you got a child of the summer, right? But if you got J.S. Bach and sat him down, like, could he get Seinfeld? I don't think he could. I think he would know what the hell was going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you played him, I don't know, Philip Glass or something, like, is he really going to get it? I don't know. I feel like he wouldn't. I feel like it wouldn't speak to him. So, you know, I don't want to be absolutist. I'm not saying, like, there's no appreciation of old art possible. But there is a, there's always going to be some barrier between us and them. Whereas when you look at the art of our own time, there is no barrier there because we are the original context. Does that make sense? And even in my own lifetime, I feel that's been lost. Like, I feel like Zoomers just cannot experience those things in the same way that I do because they just don't get the, you know, vast number of references that are required to truly get them, you know? Ones that you could never catch up on because we were just surrounded by this stuff. It was just stuff like you'd walk in and it was just be on TV or something, you know, or it was just like on a billboard or like you can't recreate all of that for someone who was born in like the year 2004, you know, it's just not possible. So anyway,
I saw a YouTube short format the other day where the person was being a Zoomer, like dancing to their favorite song and saying how great the beat was. And then a millennial would come along and say, would say, actually, that's our song. And the music would change a little bit and it would be the song that the Zoomers song was sampling. And then the millennial would then be bashed out of frame by somebody who was a Zennial or a Gen X or whoever, or even a boomer. And they would play then the beat in its original context. I feel like this is almost like a format that Jameson might make to push his ideas, because it is showing how the context is lost and people enjoy the thing that's in their moment, but it's always a reinterpretation or a reinvention of something that was from the generation previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think then, as a summary, that the postmodernists actually discovered lots of correct and interesting ideas, and we can embrace some of their insights, but we don't have to believe them entirely, right? We don't have to import the Marxism. We don't have to import the cult, the kind of moral relativism or the other social agendas, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Leotard side gives us tools that we can use to destroy boomer truth, right? But that doesn't, you don't necessarily have to do that in a completely nihilistic way. Which is, I mean, if I had a criticism of that style of postmodernism, it's kind of nihilistic, right? They're just kind of, there's a thrill of destruction in it and nothing else, right? They're not replacing it with anything. Whereas if you were doing that, obviously, you know, you've still got your God and Bible at the back of your mind or whatever. But on the other side, on the Jameson side. I do think that it's useful to just know that you cannot embody another time, no matter how much you want to, and that will put an end to a lot of LARPing that we see around the place. You know, you have to at some point come to terms with the fact that we're here in 2023, and I see a lot of people who want to take this attitude of, oh, I just want to, I'm not going to watch any films, I'm not going to listen to any music, I'm just going to reject the entirety of the culture because, like, it's a little bit paused or something. That's not possible. You can't live your life that way. You have to just be realistic about where you are. So that's why I think it's kind of useful to just embrace that, just to come to terms with it, you know? Anyway, hi, Frody, you're right.
We're back to This Evening Now, and in 35 minutes, James Garner stars in The Rockford Files. That's after Film 83 with Barry Norman.
and welcome to Film 83. And why not? I'm Barry Norman. Next year marks the release of Edgar the 14th, the final film in the Edgar franchise, which started all the way back in 1934, where a young director called Morcar started Morcar Studios. And in tonight's special program, we're going to be looking back at the series, asking ourselves what those films were about, with some quotations from the director himself and cast members as well. We're going to be looking at some of the lore and some of the hidden story behind the Edgar characters. And we're going to be considering why this cult horror franchise, which struggled to do well with both audiences and critics alike, has had such an enduring legacy. And why not? Morcar Studios opened in 1930 after Morcar, then aged 18, sold off some old armor that was shaped like an onion. It took him 4 years to produce and release Edgar, and he had a vision of creating a 20-film cycle chronicling the imminent threat to white Protestant America. Edgar was a 17th century vampire, and the protagonists in the film, the heroic couple, were White Knight and Damsel, who were described as a typical, wholesome American couple. Now, Edgar I was Count Edgar von Morcar, born in 1744. He was the heir to a great estate in Austria, and somehow, during his life, he contracted vampirism, which made him immortal until being killed with a stake by White Knight in 1911. In 1937, Morcar completes Edgar II with the same core cast, that is John Dee as the villain, Charles Mayne as White Knight, and Poe the Person as Damsel. And he says that White Knight and Damsel represent the eternal Aryan man and Aryan woman struggling to survive in a hostile world. Star actor John Dee, reputedly unhappy with being made to wear a latex Nosferatu mask in Edgar II, requests never again to have his face covered up by rubber. He said, "I am an actor. I have so much more to offer than cheap Halloween thrills." Edgar II is a Nosferatu-like vampire who dwells in a squalid basement with an unexplained pet gorilla, played by Semyagog. Damsel is a normal girl trying to have a bath in peace, while White Knight is a swashbuckling cowboy. Now, Edgar II was actually Edgar I's son, who was born disfigured, likely due to vampirism, sometime in the 19th century, and subsequently he was disowned and disinherited by his father, Edgar I. He lives on scraps at the edges of society, and of course he was killed with a stake through the heart by White Knight in
1922. Yes, good bone. Digging wild and
Irritated by his lack of critical or commercial success, Morcar spends 7 torturous years on his magnum opus, Edgar III, which opened in 1944. It featured John Dee as a classic vampire count and Semiagog as a giant werewolf. Audiences were confused by its convoluted plot and sinister ending. When asked why the villains won in Edgar III, Morcar said, "We live in a cold world where the heroes seldom win. Look at what is happening in Germany. A man stands up for Europe and his race, and look how the world treats him. Aryan man and Aryan woman have lost." Edgar III is a vampire count who is risen from the dead after an unknown werewolf howls at the moon. White Knight and Damsel are a young couple trying to enjoy a forest getaway where they are hunted by both Edgar III and the werewolf. Edgar III was the grandson of Edgar I. His own father, name unknown, is said to have been killed by Edgar I. Edgar III, meanwhile, was raised personally by Edgar I as his heir. He killed the original White Knight and Damsel in 1925, but then was later killed himself by Blue Knight in 1948. Now, people who have enjoyed the Edgar movies, but perhaps not are its most ardent fans, may have missed the fact that there is not just one White Knight and one Damsel, but several of them throughout the movies. The first White Knight died here in Edgar III. We should have a few notes about the first White Knight, because the character of the various White Knights and the various damsels changes, and much like in other franchises such as Doctor Who, it's worth knowing the various differences between the various White Knights and damsels. So the first White Knight is a heroic and swashbuckling hero who is always there to save the day. He has a romantic soul, and you can see him as the archetypal hero in many ways. He's confident, he's heroic, and he lives up to his name, White Knight. The first damsel, meanwhile, who was also killed in Edgar III, is the stereotypical damsel in distress. She was pursued and tortured by three different vampires, Edgar I, Edgar II, and of course Edgar III, who eventually killed her. And anybody who knows the subsequent genesis of the series will know that these characters develop and change over time. The second White Knight and Damsel, as we'll see, are somewhat different. Now, in 1945, since Edgar III, which had taken a very long time to make, almost bankrupted the studio, Morcar rushed out Edgar IV, a back-to-basics affair with John Dee starring Edgar IV, who was a mummy. However, it shocked audiences by casting Damsel as the hero and a hunter who saves White Knight from peril. The film gets a positive critical and box office response and was the most commercially successful Edgar to date at that point. However, Morcar himself was bitter that Edgar IV received more attention than his passion project, Edgar III, and he lashed out at liberal critics. And this is a direct quotation from Morcar. He said, "No, the film is not about feminism. It's about how, in this hellish world, the Aryan man can no longer play his role such that the woman must act as a man." Edgar IV is an ancient mummy who also controls a zombie minion, played by Semiagog. They ambush White Knight, who is described as a young dandy. Damsel is a swashbuckling adventurer who carries a machine gun with which she uses to mow down Edgar IV, the mummy. Now, Edgar IV is thought to be the entombed and mummified son of Edgar III, who was killed by his father because he was not born with vampirism and would not contract it. How he came to be animated is unknown, but he was shot and killed with a machine gun by the second damsel in 1927. Morcar now spends 5 long years working on Edgar V, which is released in 1950. It is a sci-fi horror set in space with a lavish budget and cutting-edge special effects. John Dee, of course, plays Edgar V, an intergalactic clown warlord with robot minions. The plot sees White Knight and Damsel turned into space slaves. The opening scene of Edgar V features Damsel once again appearing to, quote-unquote, act as the man in a passionate kissing scene with White Knight. Although the hero eventually saves the day, liberal critics doubled down on claiming that Morcar was a pioneer of women's lib. The director angrily hit back at his critics yet again. "No," he said, "the film is a revolt against the modern world, a world where women think they are men, and in which technology has run away from the spiritual essence of Aryan man. It is a film that hates the worship of technics," he said. Edgar V is an intergalactic space lord who seeks to abduct young slaves for his own amusement. White Knight and Damsel are a young couple who are deeply in love. Now, Edgar V was very likely the son of Edgar IV. His mother sent him away to study with mystics when he was 12 years old. He somehow acquired a spaceship and became an intergalactic space lord. He kidnapped the second White Knight and the second Damsel, who then proceeded to burn his ship down and killed him in 1935. And it should be noted that the Edgar films are not necessarily set in the year that they were made. So this film was released in 1950, but it was set in 1935.
Well, I don't know. Do you know what?
Now, after Edgar V came in over budget, Morcar was forced once again to rush Edgar VI, a much tighter and less meandering effort. The film angered conservatives because the central villain was a lipstick-wearing priest who forces White Knight to dig his own grave. Again, Morcar lashed out at his critics, this time conservative critics. He said, "I'm saying that your religion didn't save you. I'm saying the church lost its way. Our society is being torn apart, and what do conservatives do? Criticise the one director in this town who isn't a foreign subversive." Edgar VI is a deranged renegade priest who wears makeup and likes to make people dig their own graves. White Knight and Damsel in this film are a loving couple who suffer a car crash, and it is not quite clear whether the events after the car crash happened in the minds of Damsel or White Knight, or how they fit in to the rest of the narrative, and Morcar has never explained it. Edgar V, if you remember from the previous film, had two sons to two different women, and both of those sons were trained as mystics in the same secret temple sect. Edgar VI became a priest. It's not clear if he ever had genuine Christian faith, but nonetheless he was accepted into the priesthood. He wore makeup as a tribute to his father and killed the second White Knight. And on that score, we should talk a little bit about the second White Knight and how he differed from the first one. The second White Knight appeared in Edgar IV, Edgar V, and Edgar VI. He was less confident than the first White Knight. He needs to be saved by Damsel in Edgar IV, and he is submissive to her, notably in Edgar V, although he does save her from capture in that film. He saves the day. But then in Edgar VI, he is forced to dig his own grave, and many fans of the film have thought that this scene where the second White Knight is digging his own grave is a metaphor for what Morcar sees as the American people doing to themselves. In 1954, Morcar releases Edgar VII, in which John Dee plays the titular wizard with a crystal ball who turns White Knight into a giant yellow chicken. The film's final scenes, which features the giant chicken punching a heavily pregnant damsel, shocked audiences. Morcar, by this point in his career, had developed a crippling food addiction. He was despondent and bitter at the establishment, and when asked about the controversy around Edgar VII, he said, "The yellow chicken is you. The yellow chicken is American men who are so craven that they would punch a pregnant woman." Edgar VII is an evil wizard who can cast polymorphic spells through a crystal ball. White Knight and Damsel are a struggling couple who stop off in a cheap and sleazy motel because they cannot afford a better room. The latter is heavily pregnant. The former is suffering from a crippling existential crisis of confidence and masculinity. Edgar VII is the second son of Edgar V and stayed as a pure mystic specializing in polymorphic spells. He caused the third White Knight to kill the second damsel in 1936. And speaking of the second damsel, it is worth pausing on how her character differed from the first one. She was feisty and heroic. She killed Edgar IV, but is never quite the same after the car crash that we see in Edgar V. And she's definitely not the same after being forced to watch the second White Knight bury himself in Edgar VI. In Edgar VII, she is pregnant, of course, but very subdued in that film, only to be killed by a polymorphed third White Knight. By 1961, Morcar had lapsed into a deep depression, eating more and more, visibly putting on weight. He took 7 whole years to complete Edgar VIII, a film which features cross-dressing, cuckoldry, damsel cast as a Nazi, and the first gay kiss in Morcar Studios history, and possibly in the history of horror films. Conservatives call for the film to be banned. Morcar defended Edgar VIII, which he considered to be his personal masterpiece. And this is what he said. "Once again, idiot critics do not understand my work. Aryan man has been feminized, literally turned into a woman, and humiliated. His lands are raped by hostile foreigners, and women are turned into monsters." And then he continued. "Edgar has always been a symbol of the dark outsider, the forces seeking to destroy our people. But in this film, Edgar VIII, he's more like an avenging angel who puts what Aryan woman has become out of her misery. The pathetic cuckold, White Knight, still tries to save her." Edgar VIII, of course, practically bankrupted the studios as both critics and audiences hated the film, and it cost a lot of money to make over 7 years. Edgar VIII is a mysterious detective reminiscent of J.B. Priestley's Inspector from An Inspector Calls. Damsel is a neo-Nazi who wears a uniform around the house and openly cheats on her husband, White Knight, who has been feminized by her and is forced to wear a dress. She, of course, carries on with Afro Dude in front of White Knight before she is killed. Now, in terms of some of the lore behind Edgar VIII, very little is known about him, other than that he was very likely the secret bastard son of Edgar VI, that's the priest, if you recall, who had been having extracurricular liaisons outside the church. He killed a third damsel in 1952 before being murdered with a shotgun by the third White Knight. This of course means that the third damsel only appeared in one film. She, as a neo-Nazi, was a very nasty character who cheats on her husband and bullies him, quite literally forcing him to be a woman. He washes the dishes in one scene as she watches TV and makes out with other men. She is killed, of course, by Edgar VIII. 1963's Edgar the Ninth continued the Nazi theme as John Dee took up the titular role as a Nazi officer who arrests, tortures, and interrogates both White Knight and Damsel with shocking scenes of violence. Audiences were keen to note that Dee's character appears to wear an American hat, once again sparking controversy among conservatives, especially with memories of the Second World War still not that far away in 1963. Morcar himself said, "It's an angry film because I am angry. Yes, the Nazi wears an American hat because we live in a totalitarian state that censors what it doesn't like. My last film they try to shut down and ban because their peanut brains don't understand my art." Edgar the Ninth is a high-ranking Nazi officer in a world where Germany won the war and conquered America, an alternative timeline, if you like. White Knight and Damsel work in an office that is raided by the Nazis, who then beat and torture them. Now, Edgar the Ninth was the high-ranking Nazi official son of Edgar the Seventh. And we should note yet again that in the universe of the Edgar films, it was Germany that won World War II and therefore ran America and not the other way around. He brutally tortured and beat up the fourth damsel and the third White Knight before mysteriously leaving with a briefcase in 1955. Later on in Edgar the Ninth Returns, of course, he is killed by the Blue Knight. In 1964, still staving off bankruptcy, Morcar rushed out the next Edgar film, Edgar the Tenth, his leanest film in years, with John Dee playing the titular character, a psychopathic killer cop who strangles White Knight to death before drowning Damsel in the bath. Critics say that it's clear that the experience of Edgar the Eighth had turned Morcar against America, to which he responded, "Of course I'm against America. Who wouldn't be? The police aren't on your side. They serve the money power. They strangle our creativity. When he drowns Damsel, that's Edgar the Eighth they're drowning. That's what you all did to my baby. You did this, all of you." Now, shortly after the release of Edgar the Tenth, Morcar checked himself into rehab and stopped making films for a period of time and gave his blessing to Farrow. At that point, he'd just been a henchman, an extra in the studio playing monsters and background characters. And he gave his blessing for Farrow to direct a series of sequel movies, starting with Edgar the Third Returns. But let's concentrate on Edgar the Tenth a moment. Edgar the Tenth is a sadistic cop who kills innocent victims because he believes the world is no longer worth saving. White Knight and Damsel are a high school couple with their whole lives ahead of them. Now, Edgar the Tenth was also the son of Edgar the Seventh. Both the brothers were called Edgar in honor of Edgar the Fifth. He was a cop and he murdered people because he believed the USA was beyond redemption. In 1962, he finished what his brother, Edgar the Ninth, the Nazi, if you recall, had started and killed the fourth damsel and the third White Knight. Which means, of course, that we need to pause on the third White Knight to dwell a little bit on his character. The third White Knight was a dark and complicated character beset by a crisis of masculinity. After he is forced to kill the pregnant second damsel in Edgar the Seventh, he is feminized by the third damsel in Edgar the Eighth, and by the time we see him in Edgar the Tenth, he is a sad and shell-shocked husk of a man who is put out of his misery by the psychopathic cop. The fourth damsel, meanwhile, is a strong and determined character who is then brutally murdered by Edgar the Tenth in the bathtub. So in 1966, Farrow takes the hot seat, the director's chair, for the first time and makes Edgar the Third Returns, with Morcar still in rehab. John Dee reprises the role of Edgar III, the classic vampire count. And why not? Semiagog debuts as Blue Knight, who has set himself on a mission to hunt down every Edgar that is still at large and at live in the world. Edgar III, unfortunately, does very poorly at the box office in a climate during which horror was not en vogue, because action thrillers were de rigueur, all the rage in 1966, of course. Morcar, meanwhile, still sitting in rehab, absolutely hates the film and denounces it. He says, it's derivative. Pharaoh has no artistic talent. He's just copied what I was doing 20 years ago. It deserves to fail. So we come to 1967. With Morcar still in rehab, Pharaoh completes another quick sequel, Edgar VI Returns. Morcar, who saw the film from his room in rehab, said, Pharaoh will never understand the reactionary themes of my films. These sequels are as moronic as the audiences who paid to see them. In Edgar VI Returns, the Blue Knight makes the evil priest Edgar VI atone for his sins by making him dig his own grave before shooting him into it. And so we come to 1970. Morcar finally comes out of rehab, and his anger at the world has seemingly turned into laughter. He releases Edgar the 11th, featuring John Dee playing the titular character, a clown who torments White Knight with pranks, only to be shot in cold blood by Damsel. The final scene of Edgar the 11th causes controversy, as Damsel licks White Knight's face. With both Poe, the person, and Charles Maine turned 60, critics decried the scene as disgusting, and Morcar refused to take interviews. He did, however, release the following statement to the press. He said, "My latest film is about laughing at absurdity so as not to despair in the face of the grim horror that is our world. I am the one laughing, and all of you are the clowns." Edgar the 11th is a maniac clown who raids a high school and then tries to kill all of the students. He is apprehended by Damsel, who shoots him dead before licking White Knight's face. Now, Edgar the 11th was the son of Edgar the 9th. And in order to understand what has happened here, we need to pick up on a crucial detail from Edgar the 9th, which is that in one scene he carries a briefcase, which is later exchanged with an unknown officer in Edgar the 9th Returns. Now, this briefcase contained the location of a deep underground lair where Edgar the 9th had sent his three sons, who were all called Edgar. These three sons were Edgar the 11th, Edgar the 12th, and Edgar the 13th. Edgar the 11th was the oldest of these three sons, and he was raised in the aforementioned underground lair, where he studied his great-grandfather, Edgar the 5th, focusing on mastering circus tricks and clownery. He murdered a high school student in High Valley School in 1975, and he was then killed by Damsel. In 1971, Farrow released yet another shoestring sequel, the quickie Edgar the Seventh Returns, which sees Edgar the Seventh, an evil wizard who can turn people into chickens with his crystal ball, return. Blue Knight is turned into a chicken but kills Edgar the Seventh with a shotgun nonetheless. Now, Morcar once again decried Farrow's sequel. The metaphor of the blue chicken in my original was about how Aryan Man has lost his way. By having the yellow chicken perform this act of revenge, this dunderhead has undone my symbolism. In Edgar the Seventh Returns, Blue Knight tracks down the evil polymorphic wizard Edgar the Seventh and his crystal ball. Despite being turned into a yellow chicken, Blue Knight is still able to kill Edgar the Seventh with a sawn-off shotgun. By 1972, the effects of the rehab wore off and Morcar's crippling food addiction came back, and he became more and more despondent, refusing to work. Farrow plugged the gap by pumping out yet another sequel, Edgar the Ninth Returns, as we finally see the Nazi officer find his comeuppance against the avenging angel, the Blue Knight. When Morcar saw the film, he flew into a rage. He said, "My original was supposed to say that American society is no better than Nazi society, and in many ways it is worse. Farrow is a box thinker. His imagination is completely conventional." Farrow, uniquely for him, fired back and said, "Morcar needs to understand that we're not in the 1930s anymore. Audiences expect the heroes to win sometimes. Also, I am fixing plot holes that he left. For example, the briefcase from Edgar the Ninth passed on here, and this provides vital clues as to Edgar the Twelfth's backstory. Edgar the Ninth Returns sees Edgar the Ninth, following the defeat of his battalion in the Vietnam War, finally send his briefcase, which contains the secret plans to the secret lair, the aforementioned lair, to its destination before Blue Knight blasts him with his signature sawn-off shotgun. Now, in 1974, with Morcar still refusing to make another film, Farrow directed Edgar the Tenth Returns. The killer cop is now in jail and is stabbed in the back by Blue Knight. Farrow has called the Blue Knight an avenging angel, revenge incarnate. Morcar finally snaps when he sees this film. He says, "That will be the last of these infernal sequels. I will direct. I will make Edgar the Twelfth. Farrow must not be allowed to make another film. Edgar the Tenth was a masterpiece about how the US state has turned against Aryan Man. This sequel fails in every sense." Edgar the Tenth returns, sees the killer cop in jail. Blue Knight turns up with a machete and stabs him in the back before leaving. And that is indeed the last of the sequel films. Now, while Morcar did not like the sequel films, what did the other members of the cast think of them? Well, it just so happens that they went to a fan convention recently in which they were asked what did they make of the sequel films, as along with other questions. And I was going to share some of their answers here. John Dee said, "First, Semiagog was a darling and a joy to work with, always the first on set, always knew his lines and a great professional, and not bad looking either. Blue Knight is a great character an avenging angel, as Pharaoh calls him. He also said that Pharaoh was a very different director from Walker. He always worked to the deadline, very workmanlike, kept his eye on the budget. Perhaps he was less creative, but certainly he was easier to work with. And then John Dee said, I really quite liked the sequels. As an actor, I relished the opportunity to revisit old parts and to explore the different sides of the characters. Charles Maine said of the sequels, they were great for me and Poe because we got loads of time off. Haha. But seriously, Pharaoh, John and Semi did a great job with those. I was always rooting for Blue Knight because that was most often me he was avenging. Haha. And then Poe had this to say on the sequels. She said, like Charles said, it was a great time off for us. But despite what Morcos says, I really like them. It's not like every movie has to be an arthouse film. You know, sometimes you just want popcorn, and who doesn't want to see Blue Knight blasting Edgar's head off? And Semiagog, who was also at the convention, said, they were my baby, man, and come on, Blue Knight kicks all kinds of ass. You've got to see each one as the follow-on from the original. If Edgar the Sixth made White Knight bury himself, then Blue Knight was gonna do that back to him. It's real Old Testament, man. Morcar took 4 long years to complete Edgar the Twelfth, which was released in 1978. 8 years since Morcar's last film, which was, of course, Edgar the Eleventh in 1970. It featured John Dee as a pyromaniac with a sidekick called Bunny Boy. High budget and action-packed, heavy on special effects, some wondered if Morcar remembered he was meant to be making a horror film at all. There was controversy during the filming of Edgar the Twelfth, as Morcar had hired an 18-year-old actress called Saffron and forced her to have breast implants. Then, in her second scene, her character, BJ Cocaine, is sent flying off the side of the building by an explosion. Morcar insisted that all the actors had to do their own stunts, and Saffron was badly injured in the landing, breaking her leg in the process. Rather than show sympathy, Morcar raged at her for messing up the stunt, and Saffron subsequently quit Morcar Studios immediately after the release of the film. Of Edgar the Twelfth, Morcar had this to say, "Don't ask me about the silly behaviour of clumsy children. She has no place in this business. This film is my 12th masterpiece. Don't despair at the world. Don't laugh at the world. Burn it down. Burn it all down. That's my message." Edgar the Twelfth is a crazed pyromaniac with a giant Bunny Boy sidekick, played by Semiagog. He launches fire bombs at White Knight and Damsel, killing their young friend BJ Cocaine in the process. However, he is caught by our heroes and killed by Damsel, who then slow dances with an aging White Knight. Now, Edgar the Twelfth was the second son of Edgar the Ninth. He was raised in the same underground lair as Edgar the Eleventh. He studied his grandfather, Edgar the Seventh, and mastered both the arts of polymorphy and pyromancy. He killed BJ Cocaine, but then was himself killed by Damsel.
He's talking about the percentage, and he said, "Bonds and dreams and things."
Morcar then took 5 more long years to make Edgar the 13th, with John Dee, Poe the Person and Charles Maine, all aged 71 by this point. Production was surprisingly harmonious, except for the director, who gorged himself on food, often refusing to come to the set. And immediately after the release of Edgar the 13th, Morcar quit the studio and requested for his name to be taken off the film. Edgar the 13th is set in a jungle, with Damsel donning the same costume, the safari outfit seen in Edgar the 4th, with John Dee as a mysterious ninja who poisons White Knight. After defeating the ninja in a kung fu duel, Damsel sees Blue Knight from the sequel film walking his dog and falls in love. Morcar had this to say on his last film: "I wanted my name taken off it. I hate Edgar. I hate John Dee. I hate Poe the Person. I hate Charles Maine. I hate this stupid series. I hate the film industry. And I only included Kung Fu to show you how stupid you all are. I want to drink poison and die." Edgar the 13th is a ninja who follows White Knight and Damsel to the jungle. He murders White Knight by poisoning his drink. Damsel takes him on a martial arts fight and wins, killing him in the process. She sees Blue Knight walking his dog and falls in love with him. Edgar the 13th was the third son of Edgar the 9th. He was raised in the same underground lair as his brothers. He studied the fighting techniques of his father and became a master ninja. He murdered the 4th White Knight and was killed by Damsel. At this point, it's probably worth pausing on the extensive family tree of the Edgars. Here you can see the first 10 Edgars, starting with Edgar von Morcar, Edgar the First. As we talked about, Edgar the Second was his disowned son. Then he had another son whose name we don't know, who he also disowned and killed. But then Edgar the Third was raised as Edgar the First's heir. And if you remember, his son Edgar the Fourth would not contract vampirism, and so Edgar the Third killed Edgar the Fourth and wrapped him as a mummy. Somehow Edgar the Fourth came back alive later. We don't know how that happened. But also, unbeknownst to Edgar the Third, Edgar the Fourth's wife hid their son, Edgar the Fifth, away at the age of 12. She sent him to train at a secret temple. And Edgar the Fourth, Edgar the Fifth, remained there until he was older. Somehow he became an intergalactic space lord. And on his travels, he actually married twice. His first wife gave birth to Edgar the Sixth, who then had, it is thought, a son of his own, the mysterious Edgar the Seventh, the inspector. The Edgar the Eighth, the inspector from that film. But then with his second wife, he had Edgar the Seventh, the polymorphic crystal wizard character, who then had two sons of his own, Edgar the Ninth and Edgar the Tenth. And then, as we have just talked through, Edgar the Ninth had three sons himself who were sent to a secret underground lair to be raised in various different disciplines. Edgar the 11th, of course, was the clown. Edgar the 12th was the pyromaniac, and Edgar the 13th trained as a ninja. And that concludes the Edgar family tree. Now, since we are at this junction, we should also note that there's been another significant death in this film, and that is the death of the 4th White Knight, who's actually been with us all the way from Edgar the 11th. The 4th White Knight was subdued, he was visibly aging, and often needed to be saved by Damsel. He has, throughout his appearances, virtually no heroic moments beyond perhaps holding Edgar the 12th for Damsel to punch. Generally, he's treated by a plaything by Damsel. Of course, in that one scene, she licks his face. In another scene, she kind of pats his backside as they're slow dancing. And then he's killed very quickly in Edgar the 13th. So we reach the present day, with the cast set to retire and Morcar gone. Pharaoh stepped in to
the director's chair to direct his first and last mainline Edgar film, Edgar the 14th. It features John Dee as a ghost who kills White Knight and Damsel. And at the end of the film, the ghost is revealed to be Edgar the 1st. Morcar only had this to say on Edgar the 14th. He said, "Can't you let me die in peace? Can't you go away and let me die in peace? I want to eat another burger. Fetch me a burger. Get me a burger." Farrow, meanwhile, the director of the film, had this to say. "The film is about the endless cycle of life, the endless cycle of horror. The series ends as it begins, with the rising of a 17th century vampire, Edgar the 1st. I know Morcar hates me in my films, but everything I've done, I have done it for him, and I hope he gets well soon." Edgar the 14th sees the world in flames. Cities are in flames. White Knight and Damsel are hunted by a mysterious ghost. White Knight is suffering from a nervous breakdown, and the ghost channels the negative energy from White Knight and uses it to kill both him and, via a mysterious psychic link, Damsel. Her death then resurrects the ghost, Edgar the 1st. Now, Edgar the 14th was a ghostly apparition that haunted the 5th White Knight and the 5th Damsel. When they die, he absorbs their life essence to reveal himself as Edgar the 1st. It is said that he needed the blood of 10 Aryan heroes, 5 male and 5 female, to resurrect himself. So he had 5 White Knights and 5 damsels, and that was enough to bring Edgar the 1st back. That probably gives us scope now to have a look at the final iteration of Damsel, the 5th Damsel, who was the heroine from Edgar the 11th until the very end of the series. She was the ultimate evolution of the character, heroic, forward. She took action. She killed all 3 of Edgar the 9th's sons. That's Edgar the 11th, 12th, and 13th. And she completely dominates White Knight throughout her films. She falls in love with Blue Knight, and eventually she is killed by the ghost of Edgar the 1st. And this is a good juncture to read some of the quotations from that aforementioned fan convention at which Poe the Person featured. She had quite a lot to say about the series and about her iconic character, Damsel. Poe said this: "It was a groundbreaking series. Everyone thought it was just this classic damsel in distress. But as the series went on, Damsel became a genuine action hero. To be doing this in 1945 was revolutionary. Of course, Morcar wasn't doing it for feminism or anything like that, but Damsel is nonetheless an icon. That's what she's become." When asked what her favourite Edgar movie was, she said, "For me, it's Edgar the 4th and Edgar the 13th. Both of the ones where I'm in the safari suit. To me, that's the essence of Damsel. She's so kick-ass. I don't like Edgar the 11th much because he cast me as a schoolgirl when I was 58. I look quite old in that one." When asked about White Knight, she said, "Did Morcar make him too weak by the end? Maybe, but he had his reasons. Charles was a brilliant actor. He could go to playing from a masculine, swashbuckling hero to a vulnerable woman facing a nervous breakdown. How many other actors have that sort of range?" And then when asked about her own character, Damsel, she said, "When you play one character for so many years, people mistake you for the character itself. Many people stop and ask me in the street and say, 'There's Damsel.' And I'm cool with that. I owe my life to it, so why not? Damsel will still be with us in 100 years. And Charles Main at the same convention had similar thoughts on Damsel. He said, "First of all, let's put the rumours to bed. Poe has been happily married since 1930 and not to me, haha. But she was great to work with, and Damsel is now this massive cultural icon. I loved her in the safari suit in Edgar the 4th and Edgar the 13th." So similar thoughts. John Dee, who of course worked with Damsel on all of the films, said, "Who doesn't love her? She's feisty, she's kick-ass, as you kids say. Again, I don't like what Morcar did in Edgar the 8th, But in general, Damsel grows over the 14th film, and by the end, she's undoubtedly the hero of the franchise. But not all the cast members thought the same. This was Semyagog on Damsel. He said, Morcon never intended her to be this icon or anything like that. She's the flip side of White Knight. If she wore the pants, if she came to be the man, she was like an action hero. And that was Morcon saying, look, that's what you're doing to your women. Look, society, that's what you're doing to your women. And that was also a topic of conversation at this Comic-Con, where they asked each of the actors about the treatment of White Knight. John Dee had this to say. He said, I always thought it was a shame what Morcar did to the character. He was an empty shell by the end, and I think Charles deserved better. I felt he came to be overshadowed by Damsel. I did not like what Morcar did in Edgar VIII. Charles Mayne himself said this. Everyone says he was weakened or emasculated or whatever, but this was Morcar's vision. He was making a social comment. And isn't it true that men aren't what they were? It's a woman's world now. Ha ha. Poe said this about her co-star, her counterpart, White Knight. She said, did Morcar make him too weak by the end? Maybe, but he had his reasons. Charles was a brilliant actor. So there we go. And Semyagog said this. You've got to remember that Morcar was a dude from the 1930s. He saw the world like a man who had never left 1930. So White Knight was what he saw as the treatment of men in modern society. He wasn't being subversive. He wasn't trying to do anything like that. He was reflecting society back at itself. And so that's a good time to end. I hope you'll join me next time on Film 83, when we'll be talking about Eddie Murphy's starring role in Trading Places. Till next time.